I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Calling out others on social media for speech, behavior, views, and opinions that are considered offensive is commonplace, and the public shaming can be vicious, even career-ending. Our guest scholar and activist Loretta Ross says the cancel culture, calling people out, is counterproductive, shutting down any meaningful dialogue and any chance to hold people accountable. She says calling someone in instead of calling them out means having an honest and uncomfortable conversation that can advance the cause of social justice. Loretta Ross is associate professor at Smith College in the Program for the Study of Women and Gender. She teaches courses on white supremacy, human rights, and call-out culture. In fact, she's the author of a forthcoming book to be titled Calling In, the Calling Out Culture. And Professor Ross, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. We have a lot to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on your show.
Well, you're very welcome, and I do want to make sure that our listeners can join us as well. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Professor Ross, I mean, there is nothing new about trashing someone we disagree with or even going after their reputation. What do you think is unique about social media as a driver of cancel culture?
Well, historically, if you wanted to summon a lynch mob, you at least had to live in the community that you were summoning the mob from. Right now, you can summon 10,000 people with just a tweet. So it's the virality that is different, that these will mostly be strangers to you, but you can form them into a pile-on mob in seconds, where before you had to do a lot more work and, you know, expensive shoe leather to do it. But human behavior is human behavior. I mean, the original definition of a calling out killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel. So it's not new. It's just how fast we can do it and how permanent it seems, because it has this culture of unforgettability and unforgivability. Somebody can unearth something you tweeted a decade ago and weaponize it against you, and you'll forever be branded with that scarlet letter saying that you said or did whatever.
Do you think it's you mentioned the virality. Is it also the anonymity that obviously on social media people don't necessarily know who you are, and they may not even know the person that you're going after?
Well, anonymity has always provided cover, but I think many of the people who committed lynchings in the past themselves were anonymous. They would bring their whole families to watch the spectacle, not wanting necessarily to be identified. So anonymity does provide a certain amount of cover for immoral and cruel actions, but I don't think that's so recent either.
Let me ask you, and I hate to do a show that's all about definitions, but I do want to make sure that we're all sort of talking about the same thing. And I read some of your descriptions of the quality of cancel culture, the presumption of guilt without facts or nuance, that bad behavior means a bad person, that there's the moral high ground, a kind of moral purity, an apology is not acceptable, and guilt by association. Does that describe the cancel culture that concerns you?
Oh, absolutely, because I think that we should be able to use call-outs to hold people accountable who abuse their power or authority over others. That's what the human rights movement does, and it always has done. But I think we go too far. Instead of just punching up towards powerful people, we're punching sideways, and often we're punching downward on more vulnerable people. And that's the critique I offer in my book, that there's a better way to achieve accountability without using shaming and blaming and hate as your weapon, because then you actually descended to the level of the people you call yourself criticizing.
Has this happened to you? Have you been called out?
Oh, I always get called out. I'm a person of strong opinions, and I'm almost 70 years old. So the more your power, the larger your platform, the larger your mistakes, and the more numerous your critics. So, yes, I get called out all the time. And when it happens to me, generally, I just look to person in their eye if I can and say thank you. I thank them for giving me another perspective that I might not have considered. I don't necessarily agree with the call out, but I don't have to agree to say thank them for giving me their time and their attention. And then sometimes I pivot and say, and by the way, what's going on with you? Because you chose to come at me in such a negative way. So I want to make sure you're okay. So you can actually turn a call out into a calling in. If you are secure within yourself, if you are literally grateful that someone gave you their time and attention, and if you're willing to be self-reflective.
That takes a lot when someone criticizes or comes after someone and you say, thank you. You know, I mean, I don't know if you actually mean it, but it's a very disarming thing to say to someone who is, in a sense, going after yourself.
Well, I've worked with a lot of unlikely people in my past. You can tell from my resume. I mean, I've deprogrammed people who've been in the Ku Klux Klan and white supremacist movement. I'm a rape survivor that's helped people who are incarcerated for raping and murdering women. And so I don't assume everybody who has the capacity to hurt me is out there in the extremes of human behavior. I try to give people the benefit of the doubt because there's a lot of racially illiterate people. There's a lot of gender illiterate people. There are a lot of people who just simply haven't caught up with how rapidly our social mores are changing. And so I tend to give themselves the same benefit of the doubt that I hope somebody gives me. I'm constantly learning, and I'm hoping that other people will be given a chance to change just like people give me chances to change all the time.
In fact, you wrote, and I'm going to quote you, Professor Ross, you wrote in the New York Times, this was, more than 2 years ago, on a mountaintop in rural Tennessee in 1992, a group of women whose partners were in the KKK asked me to provide anti-racist training to help keep their children out of the group. All day they called me a, quote, well-spoken colored girl and inappropriately asked that I sing Negro spirituals. I naively thought at the time that all white people were way beyond those types of insulting anachronisms. You go on to describe what happened. What happened?
Well, it stunned me when they first called me the politely spoken colored girl, because I hadn't heard that term in a number of years. And so I had to regroup. I had to suck it in and say, okay, do I want to react to that or do I want to stay with my agenda? And then they really kind of disarmed me when they asked me if I could sing a Negro spiritual for them. And that's when I realized the extent of their racial illiteracy, yet they were doing the best that they could do in that moment. And so that's when I had to call myself in, because I could have reacted through my feelings with what they were doing, but I had to keep in mind the larger goal we were pursuing together and, you know, not let my ego trump my agenda. But it took a lot. It really took a lot. And then I got off that mountaintop before dark.
There you go. Just to be on the safe side. But just to add to what you said there, you described telling what it was like to be a young black girl growing up in this country, having your best friend call you the N-word. I mean, you got personal.
Well, it always is personal because if you're just walking through life, not thinking about anything particular about except how you're going to get through your day, and then somebody shocks you with their rudeness and jerks you out of your day, either whether it's by racially profiling or getting your gender pronoun wrong or whatever it is, you're not prepared for it. The thing that I try to teach people is that even then you have choices you get to make. You get to choose whether or not someone is going to control the tenor of your day. No one makes you angry. People do what they want to do. You choose to become angry over it. You choose often to let someone else's ineptness hurt you. And I just try to teach people that you have choices. You don't have to give people the remote control to your emotions because you may not like the channels that they choose. Use your wit, your intelligence, your sense of who you are to dictate how you want to walk through life. Don't let other people's dirty minds and dirty fingerprints determine that for you.
You mentioned the fact that you are a rape survivor. In fact, I mean, it's so painful to say this, but this was the rape, also the result of incest, a child that you had. And you have worked with incarcerated people in prison for rape and talked with them about your own experience. Can you talk a bit about that?
Oh, when I was 25, I was young and I thought that the revolution was going to be tomorrow. So I need to put that out there too, like every other young person. And so I was director of the DC Rape Crisis Center, which was the first in the country. And we'd gotten this letter from a man named William Fuller, who was incarcerated at Lorton, DC's prison. And his letter said, "Outside, I raped women. Inside, I rape men, and I'd like not to be a rapist anymore." Wow. And first of all, that was an astonishing letter to get, but I have to honestly say, it pissed us off. We were at the Rape Crisis Center, barely enough resources to help the victims of sexual violence, and here's a perpetrator asking us for help? I mean, I wanted to throw that letter in the trash. I did not have a real positive, "Oh, I'm going to call this man in" kind of response initially. And so I buried the letter under some paperwork on my desk and tried to ignore it. But I couldn't forget it. And eventually I got in my car and I went to Lorton to meet this William Fuller and found out that, yes, he had raped and murdered a black woman just like me. And not only that, but he and another guy named Larry Cannon had organized a group called Prisoners Against Rape, the first male-led organization in the country to want to end violence against women. And they did so from behind bars. And so I thought that I was going to Lorton to change William and found out that I went there and got more changed myself. Because these were men trying to recapture their humanity. They had called themselves in and decided that they didn't want to be predators anymore. And they were the biggest predators in the prison. They were like looking like MMA fighters. They were so big and buff. And I realized that later that they did that to keep from becoming prey themselves. And so I had that kind of transformative experience at 25. And I've never been able to demonize anybody ever since then, because I was prepared to delight in the fact that they were incarcerated. I wanted to tap dance on their misery. I didn't want to see them as human beings.
That is an incredibly powerful story, Loretta Ross. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. We're talking about cancel culture instead of calling people out. How about calling them in? We're going to be right back after this short break. Do stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and just a quick recap here. We are all familiar with the term cancel culture, calling people out or shaming people for past comments and actions deemed offensive. Our guest, Professor Loretta Ross, says, how about calling them in instead of calling them out? We're talking with her about how to work across all the divides that separate us and how to hold each other and ourselves accountable. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I think we get a sense of, for you, what it means to call in, to call in someone instead of calling them out. But help us understand what the dynamics of that are. And these are uncomfortable conversations, correct?
Well, a calling in is merely a call out. But you, instead of using anger and blame and shaming as your method, you're going to use love and respect. So So you're still seeking to hold a person accountable, but instead of coming at them like, I can't believe you said that, kind of anger or humiliation kind of approach, which is really an invitation to a fight, you come at them and you say, well, you know, that's an interesting thing that you just said. Tell me more about it. That's a totally different approach. You're still calling attention to what you found interesting or problematic, but instead of making assumptions about the person or the person who said it or what they said, you're inviting them into a conversation. Quite often, just you're stopping to say, that's interesting, tell me more, will cause them to revisit what they just said or rethink about it, maybe sometimes even walk the words back. But when you invite people to a conversation, you increase the likelihood that they're willing to examine what they've done or what they've said, as opposed to when you accuse them of malintention or bad behaviors, then you make them defend themselves. You make them sometimes attack others. You shut them down instead of opening them up. And that's why I think calling in is a much more effective and productive tactic.
You mentioned the fact that you're a 70-year-old black woman, so you have lived through a lot, myself included. I'm a 70-year-old white woman. But nonetheless, do you think we live in a more angry time these days, where the sort of default is to be angry and accusatory?
Well, I don't know if I can compare times. I've lived long enough to remember when you couldn't even make a phone call without going through an operator, and the whole neighborhood heard you gossip about your neighbors.
So. Yes, right. Been there, done that, yes.
You know, I don't know if I want to compare different times, because human beings are human beings. We just have better toys and tools nowadays, but we're still the same old messed up, complicated people trying to do the right thing and quite often not knowing how. And that's the assumption that I bring into trying to establish how I want to walk through the world and how I want to deal with the people in the world with me. Not assuming that this is worse now than it's ever been. I mean, as a black person, it's kind of hard for me to say that. I mean, my mother cleaned white folks' houses on her hands and knees while raising 8 kids. How can I not say my life is not better than hers, even though I'm still dealing with the same forces of racism, white supremacy, and everything that she had to deal with? And so I try not to get into hyperbole and this, oh, woe is me kind of feeling about myself. My mother actually said that about me when she sent me off to college. She said she really admired the fact that I don't let success go to my head. Which, you know, I kind of was like, yeah, Mom, you know, I read the same Reader's Digest you read, blah, 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 right in my mouthy self. She says, shut up. What I was trying to say is that you don't let success go to your head, but most importantly, you don't let failure go to your heart.
Oh, wow.
And my mother read that in me at 16, when I was 16 years old. And so that's been my motto through life.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
I'm better about myself.
And just to follow up on that, I mean, it sounds like for you the default is when people say things that are offensive or racist, is that they don't know any better. Is that the sort of default for you, rather than they are a racist or a homophobe or, you know, any of these other isms or phobes?
I don't have a default until I find out more information. That's why I always have that tell me more thing. Because I do have a different strategy for dealing with people who purposely are hurtful and purposely are hateful. That's a totally different strategy for dealing with them, people who are willing to monetize and weaponize people's pain against them so that they can manipulate them. Those people, I'm ready to overpower and organize against, because I'm not giving them the benefit of the doubt. Their motives are quite transparent. And when they show me who they are, I believe them. On the other hand, there's a lot more people who may exhibit those behaviors that are not doing it out of meanness, viciousness, or their abandonment of humanity. and stuff like that. And those are the people that I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt to and seek to see if I can work with them. But then there may be a point that I have to work around them too. But I don't know until I ask the question. So that's what I'm defaulting to. I'm defaulting against making assumptions without giving people the benefit of their humanity. Ask the question so that you know what you're dealing with rather than assuming.
Well, and just to underscore what you said there, I don't know if friendship is too strong a word, but you, I guess, have a friendship with Floyd Cochran, former national spokesman for the Aryan Nations.
Yeah, Floyd was interesting because he called the Center for Democratic Renewal where I worked, and we used to monitor hate groups. That was our job. And so when Floyd called in his deep bass voice, "This is Floyd Cochran. I want to speak to Leonard Zeskin." The first thing I blurted out was, "D. Floyd Cochran?" It was like meeting a celebrity, right? A Nazi celebrity. And he said, "Yes." And I was stuttering and stammering because I thought it was maybe a hoax. We'd probably call it trolling now, but I wasn't sure. I couldn't do anything. I said, "Well, I'll take your number and have him call you," kind of thing. But it turned out that Floyd had been kicked off of the compound, the Aryan Nations compound, by Richard Butler, because he started questioning that Nazi philosophy that he'd grown up with since he was 14 years old. And Floyd was in his mid-30s by that time. So for 21 years, he'd been a Nazi until his second son was born with a cleft palate.
Oh, wow.
Then his Nazi buddies told him that his son was a genetic defect who needed to be culled. Well, I think that got Floyd's attention in a different way, because he was okay with hating Jewish people and hating black people and hating queer people. But when that hatred came home, it was like a wake-up call for Floyd. And so he reached out to my center. We helped him relocate away from the Aryan Nations compound and try to re-enter into life. Floyd only knew about being a Nazi from age 14. Actually, he became a Nazi because he was bullied as a child. He was a young little skinny kid in upstate New York who was always afraid until he put on a Nazi uniform. And then suddenly people became afraid of him.
Wow.
And he liked that feeling of power. And had never met a black person, had never met a Jewish person, but was able to become a Nazi. It's kind of interesting. So anyway, Floyd and I ended up on a national tour together after he defected from the Aryan Nations because he wanted to atone for all the harm that he'd done recruiting skinheads into the movement. And these two skinhead brothers named Freeman from Allentown, Pennsylvania, he had recruited into the Aryan Nations, came home one night and murdered their entire family. The mother, the father, and their 12-year-old brother. And Floyd felt responsible for that. He felt pain by that. I did too, because I had talked to the mother the week before the murder, trying to urge her to change the locks. But anyway, it's a long story. But Floyd wanted to apologize for what he'd done, and so we ended up being an unlikely couple.
Trapped in
the country. A black woman and an ex-Nazi trying to stop the hate movement.
That is an odd couple, but apparently it worked. That's Loretta Ross. She's associate professor at Smith College in the Program for the Study of Women and Gender. She teaches courses on white supremacy, human rights, and call-out culture. She's got a forthcoming book titled Calling in the Calling-out Culture. She's been on our list of people that we want to get on Radio Times, and so we're happy that she can join us, and we have a lot to talk about. Let me just make sure our listeners can join us, and I do want to read some comments here. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call 1-888-477-9499. Let me just read a couple of comments. Stu says the term cancel culture was created as a political weapon by those being fairly criticized. The same people practice cancel culture the most. I mean, it is, you know, you think of like a TV show gets canceled, right?
Well, I'm not sure if I can say the origination of the cancel culture phenomenon, but obviously people have weaponized shame and punishment for decades. I mean, let's talk about the McCarthy period, the anti-communist witch hunts that took place where people got fired and blacklisted, and even some people lost their lives. Or the continuing campaigns against culture, when people don't like Harry Potter, or when they don't like a movie or rap music, or even Elvis Presley was criticized at one point. I mean, there's always been people willing to cancel something that they think is offensive or they think should be, under their control kind of thing. But it got weaponized very recently by the Republican Party that chose to ignore the pandemic, ignore the constant wars we were in, ignoring the collapse of the economy, and chose at their 2020 convention to make the cancel culture their number one focus, the thing that they were going to most focus on, because frankly, they didn't want to be held accountable for the horrible things they were doing and saying about people. And so we've seen this totally hypocritical weaponization of the term cancel culture by a political party that doesn't want anybody to deal with the truth, doesn't want, as they said, they have their own alternative facts. I heard someone say once.
That's right.
And so we're not fooled. People recognize the hypocrisy of when it's happening by the people who are not operating in good faith. I can offer a critique of them at the same time I can offer a critique of my own human rights movement when I think we're not doing the right thing, because it's very possible to do the right thing the wrong way. And so, for example, I get in a lot of trouble because I don't think that in our effort to protest human rights violators that we should be picketing at people's homes, for example. I mean, really? Are we supposed to frighten people's children as a way to make our point? Isn't that what our opponents do? So I'm not one of those people that's going to withhold critique from my own movement simply because I offer one of the other side as well.
Yeah, I hear you. Here's another email from Colleen, who says, a huge gratitude to Dr. Ross and her message. I've considered running for elective office, but decided not to do so because I know that I will make a mistake or say something wrong. Of course I will. I'm human. And therefore, I know that I will be publicly shamed for that no matter what, how small the mistake. I don't think I'm willing to risk that. Let me just keep that out there. Let me read another email, this one from Pamela. I was shamed as a young woman by a colleague for calling some local fruit vendors Orientals. I had no idea that the word was no longer acceptable. It would have made a huge difference if she had just said the term is frowned upon now. It's better to call them Asians. I had no idea. But she felt shamed by a colleague. Anything you want to say to either of our listeners there, Colleen or Pamela?
Well, you can't deal with a mistake that you make if you don't practice self-forgiveness. And if you can't forgive yourself for your mistakes, then you're going to find it very hard to forgive others for theirs. So for people who are afraid of running for public office or saying things, don't be afraid of making a mistake. Be afraid of your inability to act like an adult when you make a mistake. Because it's the child that breaks the glass and sweeps it under the rug and hope nobody notices it. It's the adult that says, yes, I broke the glass. Now how can I buy another one or repair the harm? And that's okay. I've forgiven myself and I can get over it. And so we can't let our fear of making a mistake or saying the wrong thing keep us silent, because then it doesn't allow the fact that we are capable of growing and we're capable of looking our mistakes in the eye without any shame and really understand that when you know better, you'll do better. And that's all you really have to say to anybody. Okay, I didn't know that then. Now I know it now. Thank you for letting me know, and I'll do better in the future. If you can't practice that self-forgiveness, then you're going to let fear of making a mistake rule you. And that's fear of other people's opinions and stuff like that. And I keep saying, that's an awful way to walk through life, where your whole opinion of yourself is dictated by people who may or may not have your best interest at heart. It's a very fragile way to be. Well, and so I encourage people to get out there and make big, bad mistakes, as a matter of fact, and learn from them and do better in the future. I mean, that's all living ain't nothing but one big experiment.
Well, that is for sure. I'm also thinking of, and you teach at Smith College, so you deal with students. There are trigger warnings for, you know, some passages in particular books. There's
well, some people use them. I don't use trigger warnings.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. We have about a minute before a second break here, but I'm curious about how you deal with that.
Well, life is a trigger warning, so I don't offer you any protection from life. I ask the students very bluntly, do you want me to teach you about life or protect you from it?
And their response is?
It doesn't matter what their response is. My job is to teach, not to protect.
Do you think, again, we're almost having a break here, but do you think there's too much sort of worry about protecting people's feelings?
Well, that's because too many people don't take responsibility for the inadvertent or inadvertent harm that they do to people. If you are willing to take responsibility for what you do, then you can do better in not doing those things again. But it's not about trying to protect people from the realities of life. I cannot be an educator and promise not to educate people at the same time. I just don't see how those two thoughts exist in the same job description.
Well, that is our guest, Professor Loretta Ross, Associate Professor at Smith College. She teaches courses on white supremacy, human rights, and call-out culture. She's got an idea, several of them, as a matter of fact. One of them, how about instead of calling people out, you call them in? And again, we got a lot of people joining our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me play a clip from former President Barack Obama speaking about call-out culture. This was at an Obama Foundation summit. This was October 2019.
But I do get a sense sometimes now among certain young people, and this is accelerated by social media, there is this sense sometimes of the way of me making change is to be as judgmental as possible about other people. And that's enough. Like if I tweet or hashtag about how you didn't do something right or used the word wrong verb, or then I can sit back and feel pretty good about myself because, man, you see how woke I was? I called you out.
Professor Ross, is he correct?
I think President Obama was spot on. I admire his bravery in saying that from the pulpit that he had. I've never met him. But anyway, I think he was largely correct. Of course, he got called out for calling out the calling out culture, which is what happens when we offer a critique of how people wrongly think that that's the way they're supposed to do activism. But building the human rights movement has to be about bringing people into the movement, not driving them away from the movement. And why would anybody want to join a movement that makes them feel worse about themselves? I mean, if we're not having fun fighting fascism, we're doing something wrong.
Well, as you mentioned, you have been called out for calling in for call. You know, I sort of forget how the variations of calling in and calling out. I'm looking at a letter that you, and I have to say, a bunch of other people wrote to Harper's, a letter on justice and open debate. I'll just quote a couple of sentences. You and your fellow letter writer signers said, "The free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. affected. While we have come to expect this on the radical right, censoriousness is also spreading more widely in our culture, and intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues in a blinding moral certainty. You criticized the Republican Party and I guess conservatives earlier in the hour, and here you're criticizing people on the left.
Well, I am a critic of everybody who's entirely too judgmental, entirely too hypocritical, and has an inability to be self-aware and self-critical, because those are not useful traits to have in a pluralistic society. So for me, I really don't care what your political affiliation is. My litmus test is whether or not you violate people's human rights or support people's human rights. So I don't care what you call yourself, it's what you do that matters. And so if you treat people with judgmentalism, with censure, with intolerance, I don't care if you call yourself doing it for the right reasons, I'm still going to offer a critique of you, because there is a much better way to hold people accountable than attacking their humanity.
Let me ask you, this is a bit of a tangent here, but knowing I was going to talk to you, I was thinking about taking down Confederate statues as perhaps a form of cancel culture. I mean, it's many things, but I'm curious about how you see that, and how we sort of acknowledge our racist history and also decide to take people off, I guess, off their pedestals.
Well, it depends on who we're taking off of their pedestal. I frankly agree with taking down Confederate statues. I mean, because I don't see why you would build a statue and honor the memory of someone who committed treason against your country. I don't quite get that logic there. I mean, it would be like Germany going around and building statues to Hitler. You know, why would you want that to happen? And is that who you want to memorialize in your values that you espouse? At the same time, I take a more complicated view of people who do problematic things, who are artists or comedians or whoever. For example, there's the current Dave Chappelle controversy.
Sure.
That everybody and their mother wants to talk about. I'll just say, I think that if we hold Dave Chappelle should be held accountable for the things that he said, I suggest that you probably get better, make more headway with him by calling him in instead of calling him out.
I would like to hear that conversation.
Oh, I'd love to hear it too, because I think that we walk through world expecting the wrong things of the wrong people in many ways. I get so impatient with people who criticize artists and performers for not being the most politically woke people in the world. And I'm like, well, wait a moment. Didn't they just spend a whole lifetime learning how to sing or tell a joke? Why would you expect them to have the political chops of bell hooks or Noam Chomsky? I mean, why are you investing so much false expectation in that gift that they have, which is not going to be a gift for everything? And we're in a celebrity culture that just because someone sings very well, they're supposed to have a great political opinion too. And I'm like, that's not how life really works. But the other thing I want to say is that I think it's the most complicated, contradictory people that produce the most complex art. I don't know if I'd only want mediocre art by people who've never did or said anything wrong or didn't have very problematic lives. I mean, I don't know if I'd want to cancel a Picasso or, you know, honestly, Cosby or any of these other people that people want to so quickly cancel. Because I think sometimes the most exquisite art comes from the crucible of suffering. And so I probably have an unorthodox opinion about separating the art from the artist that probably is not very popular.
Oh, it's okay. We accept all opinions on this show. Let me get some callers to join us. We've got Philip. I believe Philip on line four. Is that correct? Yes, Philip on line four. Hi, Philip. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Professor Ross and Marty. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a truck driver. I had to pull over on the side of the road. Professor Ross, your words are so refreshing to my soul right now. If I had to characterize them by one word, I would use the word love. The idea of reconciliation between people who, you know, we're human beings. We don't even know what we think and how we think about things sometimes. But I was fired from my job a year ago at a very difficult time in my life for, quote, creating a hostile environment for making racist statements, unquote. And I never knew what I said. No one ever spoke to me. No one ever said, ouch. I embraced my company's diversity and inclusivity training. And then I found out afterwards what I had said. And I had said, I was quoting a song by Sly and the Family Stone that used to play on the radio in the 70s. The same group that did Different Strokes for Different Folks. And it used the N-word in the song. It was Don't Call Me Whitey, N-word, Don't Call Me N-word Whitey. Do you remember that song?
Sure.
Somebody must have took that out of context and labeled me in a way that just killed me. And I still, to this day, I wish, you know, I'm trying to figure out what's going on with CRT and white fragility. And there's nobody to talk to. Nobody to talk to. And I tell you, I'm going to buy your book. And I think your book should be required reading for all HR departments in the corporate world. And I just want to thank you. I wish I would buy you dinner at any place you would want to go. If I could sit down and talk to you for an hour about things to change my mind even. But I appreciate very, very much the things you're talking about today. Thank you for your common sense words.
Well, let me do a
Yeah, hold on,
commercial.
Philip. Yeah, go ahead, Loretta Ross.
Let me just do a brief commercial. I teach calling in classes online for $5 a lecture. So you don't even
you
have
go.
To spend the price of a dinner to get what I offer. I'll be starting a new class in the spring. So just look me up online, LorettaJRoss.com. I try to be the Walmart of online learning. Anybody can afford $5.
Philip, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. You said so much there. And to you, Professor Ross, I mean, what I heard from him is this, you know, this desire, this feeling of hurt because people do want to talk, but it's hard, right? It's hard to talk sometimes.
Well, I think that what happens is that we make so many assumptions about each other because we've had so much trauma that has been left unaddressed for so long. And so when people do get a chance to use the one source of power they have, which is their keyboards, you know, they're just letting loose everywhere and without any restriction. And they are often typing through their trauma and not giving people the benefit of the doubt, making quick summary judgments of people and causing a lot of harm. Also, I find a lot of damn incompetence in there too, where people who are in these positions of DEI or, you know, Title IX and stuff, and they want to be so careful not to make a mistake and not believe survivors and not to believe people who are wounded by racism or white supremacy or sexism, that they go overboard. They become overly protective and overly reactive and really does not create a container for both the accused and the accuser. They go all one way or the other. And so that's partly incompetence to play. I actually had a Title IX complaint lodged against me once by a student because I got their gender pronoun wrong. And I was like, wait a moment, I was part of the feminist movement that caused Title IX to be written in the first place. How can I be accused of sexual harassment of a student whose name I can't even remember?
Wow.
That I was accused of of misgendering the student. And at the other hand, when I misgendered another student came up to me and said, "Oh, that's all right, Professor. I misgender myself sometimes." And so one student, one 18-year-old, was able to offer forgiveness and humanity, and the other student wanted to weaponize my mistake and try to get me fired. So both of those things exist in our world at the same time. And it's a question of whether I let that determine who Loretta Ross is. And I hope that the people in these positions of power and authority learn to stop being so afraid of being honest and real, so that they cause that kind of unintentional harm with the powers that they have.
Let me read a couple of more comments. And I do want to ask you actually about Lauren Boebert and Ilhan Omar, just because that's very much in the news. But let me read a comment from CJ. "I would love to believe calling in can work, but sometimes it may not be enough. I had two guys follow me into a parking lot wanting to fight me because I had an Obama bumper sticker on. And if I wasn't 6'2 and an ex-special forces, they wouldn't have backed down. What else can be done in that situation?" He goes on to say there are a lot of very angry people out there. Heidi says, "I want to be more like Dr. Ross and learn how to call in. How does one practice reacting calmly in the moment of a racist, misogynist, or otherwise hurtful comment? It seems to come naturally to Dr. Ross. I often react quickly in anger and remain silent." And Heidi, I think a lot of us can relate to what you say. And I'm just curious to you, Professor Ross, I think we all know about what happened between Representative Lauren Boebert and Representative Ilhan Omar. Boebert sort of made this crack about Omar being a terrorist, and I shouldn't diminish that in any kind of way. They had a phone call. They ended up hanging up. Apologies not accepted. Is there a way through this based on your experiences?
Well, again, I can't offer the assumption that people who manipulate lies and hatred as a way to make themselves powerful or profitable, that they're operating in good faith. Right. I don't believe that Representative Boebert even believes half of what she's willing to spew out of her mouth as a way of feeding red meat to her base. She doesn't actually believe Representative Omar is a terrorist, but the fact that she's willing to say it and then try to pass it off as a joke or satire is a familiar tactic of the white supremacist movement. They really do want to have it both ways, say hurtful things and then get away by claiming it was a joke. We saw the defendants try to use that at the Charlottesville trial. We hear it over and over again. It is not an original tactic, is what people call themselves using today. And so I don't consider that operating in good faith. And so if you're not going to operate by the Marquis of Queensbury rules, why should I? I mean, it's kind of like, I'm going to call you out for that kind of behavior. But at the same time, there is a lot of anger out there. When I tell people what I teach, white supremacy in the age of Trump, I never know the reaction I'm going to get from people. Some people say, "Oh, I'm so glad you're doing it." And some people jump down my throat for even admitting it. But I tend to say that's based on who they are. That's not based on what I'm doing. That's what's in their hearts. And sometimes I have the mental space to listen to them. Sometimes I just shut them down, depending on where I am, because I do have the right to self-care and to not entertain somebody else's, as they used to say, tripping on the light fantastic. You get to make those choices about how you want to walk through the world, as long as you understand that you do not have to be dictated to by others who think that you're simplistic or don't understand what they're doing.
Well, Professor Loretta Ross, we got to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us as well.